It's the Burt Cohen Show. And what happens to the dream when we are reliant on nuclear power? I grew up in the 50s, Burt Cohen here, and we had a book put out by Walt Disney called Our Friend the Atom. We were taught that nuclear power was safe and clean and plentiful. It wasn't dangerous, it was secure. Well, today we're facing major tragedy. At this point in Japan, we don't know exactly what the final result will be, but chances are it'll be having its effect for decades to come, the Fukushima nuclear plant melting down. We don't know how much, if it's able to be controlled. And on the first part of the show today, our guest is Diane Darigo of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. We'll be talking about what it is, what the reality is. People don't know largely how nuclear power works. And on the second part of the show, we'll be talking with Justin Elliott, columnist for Salon.com, about the spin doctors in the nuclear industry. See if they can get out of this one. Well, Diane, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today. Should it be called nuclear power? Because then it sounds like, well, it's not oil, it's not gas, it's not coal. It's just some, you know, something that just happens. Shouldn't it really be called uranium power or even plutonium power?
Could be. You could call it uranium. You could call it plutonium. You could call it atomic power. It's called that, but it's still a contributor to global warming in that every step of the fuel chain uses carbon and emits carbon. And to enrich the fuel from the uranium when it's mined, milled, and concentrated in the uranium-235 uses enormous amounts of energy. In fact, at one point there were two huge coal plants that were used to enrich uranium for nuclear fuel, and it was a very high percent, I'm thinking in the 15-20% range of our electricity back in the earlier days. Now it's taking a little less, but it's still taking carbon-based fuels to make the nuclear fuel in the first place. And then, of course, it's not emission-free, as the industry claims, as we're seeing in Japan, but just under normal operations, there are routine releases of radioactivity into the air, the water, the environment, and waste. So now this devastating disaster, not just one, not two, but three nuclear reactors in the process of melting down, and fuel pools, over 1,000 tons of irradiated fuel, much, much hotter than the fuel in the core, possibly melting down in one of the units and could also start melting down in the other four or five fuel pools that they have at that site.
Wow, we are talking with Diane Darigo of the Nuclear Information Resource Services. Not a lot is known about what's really going on in Japan. And this show will be played on podcast and in the future, but it's being recorded just for information on March 17th. Now, at this point, solid information is sketchy. Even the Japanese government is publicly complaining about the quality and quantity of information coming from Tokyo Electric Power. But to the best of your abilities, Diane, and I know you guys have a lot of people on the ground, a lot of expertise, what can you tell us about the status of the units as we speak right now?
Well, my best information is that the units, well, what we've got in Japan, where the earthquake took place, off the shore of the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. There are six units there.
Six.
And then a bit north of that is the Fukushima Daini, and there are four nuclear power reactors there. A bit further north is another set of reactors, and then further north of that is their, as yet has not operated, reprocessing facility for irradiated nuclear fuel. So the immediate reactors that we're hearing about right now are the four of the six that are straight off from where the earthquake hit.
And
you want me to just go on
that?
Yeah,
what do we know about, I mean, I know they've been trying to cool them down. And maybe now would be a good time to explain a little bit how it works. There's fuel rods that have to be cooled down, fuel rods
sure.
that create the heat. You may remember, I can't remember which scientist it was, about 30 years ago, who basically, he defined nuclear power this way, an insane way to boil water. That's all it is. I don't remember which scientist it was, but how does it work? I mean, we get electricity because something turns a turbine. So how does...
Okay, so here's the simple description. I like to start with uranium in the ground because that's really where it starts. And uranium in the ground is mixed with other elements. There's all kinds of combinations of elements in the soil. Uranium is one of them. So in the places where there's a lot of uranium, they'll dig that out, or now there are even procedures where they'll put chemicals into the ground to extract out the uranium. And then the uranium itself, there are several different isotopes of uranium. There's uranium-235, 238, 234. There's a few of these. It's the uranium-235 that, once it's in the core of a reactor, can sustain a self-sustained chain reaction. So that's the one that they want to concentrate. They call it enrich. So what it is they concentrate, try to get as much of the U-235 and separate out the other uraniums, and that's what's referred to as depleted uranium. They use to make depleted uranium weapons, and it's not depleted in any kind of health or toxicity. It's depleted in the 235, and the 235... and they do that by turning it into a gas, and then they separate out the 235, concentrate it, turn it back into a solid, form it into little pellets, tiny little pellets, maybe the length of your thumb, the knuckle on your first on your baby finger, and you stack. They'll stack these pellets into zirconium aluminum or zircaloy rods or straws, so you've got the pellets stacked in the rods, and the rods are 10, 12, 14 feet long. So each of these rods is filled with uranium, but it's got a zirconium aluminum cladding. And then you get a couple hundred of these rods, and they're put into a certain array. They're all standing vertically, and they're held up with metal to connect them. So you've got a fuel rod assembly, and then you take, they'll take a couple hundred of these assemblies and put them into the core of the reactor, which is a big metal vessel. And I don't know how thick the vessels are in Japan, but it's that vessel that is what's protecting, is what keeping this from getting out into the ground and the ocean right now as the fuel is melting. So a couple hundred rods. About 100 rods per assembly, a couple hundred assemblies go into the core of the reactor, and then the core is flooded with water, which circulates around and serves as a moderator and a coolant. It's a moderator in the core. Neutrons are injected into the reactor to get the reaction started, and then once the uranium atoms split, uranium atoms are pretty big. They've got 92 protons and a whole bunch of neutrons. Adds up to 235. Uh-huh. So when the neutron bangs into the uranium, it splits, gives off its binding energy, which heats the water, turns to steam, turns the turbines, makes electricity. And when it splits, it forms other lighter radioactive elements like strontium-90 and cesium-137 and a bunch of different radioactive iodines. One of the iodines, 131, is shorter lasting. It's got an 8-day half-life, but One of the iodines that forms iodine-129 has a 17 million year half-life. Yeah. And the general rule is 10 or 20 half-lives is the hazardous life of the radioactive element, so or the radioactive radionuclide. So the strontium-90, the cesium-137, these have half-lives of 28 and 30 years, respectively. So they'll be hazardous for 300 to 600 years. And these get out, these are formed when the uranium atom splits. Mm-hmm. And usually these elements stay in the rods, and the rods are kept in the core for about 2, 3, 4 years, and then they are removed. When they come out of the core, they are millions of times more radioactive than that fresh fuel that went in. They can give a lethal dose in just seconds if you're exposed unshielded. So these are all put into fuel pools. The industry likes to call this spent fuel. They call it used fuel. But since it's millions of times more radioactive, it's totally accurate to refer to it as irradiated nuclear fuel. This fuel is stored then in 40-foot deep pools for as long as they can. Right. And then in the U.S., we've got a lot of reactors that are older, and they've started to put the fuel then into dry casks. So in the core of the reactor, you're relying on the circulation of the water, and then the water is supposed to turn to steam, turn to turbines, and make the electricity. In the particular design of the reactor at Fukushima 1, 2, and 3, and at Vermont Yankee, and at Pilgrim in Massachusetts, these are boiling water reactors. They are Mark I designs made by General Electric. Brings good things to life. Yeah. They do not actually have a big containment dome, a big, thick, heavy containment dome. What they have is a system that is supposed to provide containment. The theory is that when the fuel, pressure builds up, if it gets too high, then it's supposed to, the vapor is supposed to be forced down into a donut-shaped pool of water around the bottom of this pressure vessel and convert the steam back into a liquid to reduce the pressure in the reactor. Well, that didn't work, and the containment dome, well, the top of the building blew off.
Right.
And then in most of these, so I think it's in all three at this point, and then the building itself that's over the reactor, and at least two of them, that's gone.
Right.
And then the fuel in all three of the reactors there is starting to melt down,
mm-hmm.
Which means the water is gone. And, okay, and so to talk about what's going on with the accident, when the tsunami came in, the earthquake shook things. We don't know what damage the earthquake caused exactly. Then the tsunami hit, and the water that circulates around the cores was lost, and the power was lost to the reactors so that there was not a way, even if they could get water, that they could get it in. So the efforts began to bring seawater in, right. Efforts began to bring backup power in. Diesel generators worked for a while. Right now I understand that units 5 and 6 are both operating, at last I knew, on one diesel generator is powering both units 5 and 6, and that's not enough power for both, for two reactors. We also have supposedly plans to try to rewire and bring more power to the facilities, but we are seeing raising levels of radioactivity because the fuel in all three of the units 1, 2, and 3 are melting.
Right.
And what that means is without water, the fuel begins to self-melt. Now, in units 4, 5, and 6, the cores of the reactors, as I understand it, the reactor cores, the fuel was being had been moved into their fuel pools. The fuel pools are holding
right.
much of the fuel from over the decades that these reactors have been operating. So there's actually a lot more radioactivity in those pools. And that's at all six of these units, plus a more centralized pool at that site. So they've got several pools with enormous amounts of irradiated fuel from the decades of the operation of those six nuclear power plants. The first one there started up in 71, as I understand it. So we've got 40 years. And in fact, the first one to go was going to be retired on March 25th after 40 years of operation. And what's a scary thing here is that our boiling water reactors are getting rubber stamp approved license extensions. At Pilgrim, organization is heroically fighting that license extension with very serious contentions, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not want to stop that reactor when it's time to stop, and the citizens there are
not real pleased.
Well, they're fighting it, and
yes.
Maybe after this we might get some success with preventing the relicensing of that unit.
And amazingly enough, maybe because they somehow know how absolutely insane it is and all that complicated process that you described, it's amazingly complicated. As the scientist said, it's an insane way to boil water. It just boils water to turn the turbines. And it's just those so many different factors, things that can go wrong, and an earthquake and a tsunami, not good for the health of such a complex system. And this is the Burt Cohen Show, and we're fairly close to the Seabrook station, which they have already initiated well before this tragedy in Japan. they've initiated trying to get a 20-year license renewal through its current operating license, and it doesn't expire until the current license doesn't expire until 2030, and yet they've already gone in to try to get a 20-year expansion of that. Maybe they know something. And the system should be there, I would think.
Well, part of why they want to extend their licenses is so that they can project that they'll be getting more money for decommissioning down the road, and can build up those coffers.
Oh, that's what it's about, money, isn't it? About money. And of course, people here are concerned about it. And on the second part of the show, we'll be talking about the spin that the nuclear industry has been putting on it to look like it's green, it's safe energy. Well, how, Diane, do you know if, and maybe nobody knows, has the reactor vessel itself been breached? I mean, you talked about it, and I think that was very illuminating, that even aside from the reactor vessel itself, there's the nuclear fuel pool, the spent rods fuel, that in itself is incredibly dangerous. And it seems like, they're trying to get water to it in whatever way they can, like using basically squirt guns to try to cool the thing down. Do we know if the reactor vessel itself has been breached? And my understanding is that TMI, Three Mile Island, which everybody knows about now, I don't believe the reactor vessel itself was breached, but I'm sure you know more about that than I do.
Well, you asked a few things. I want to make sure that I conveyed that at Unit 4 at Fukushima Daiichi, that we know that that's the irradiated fuel pool that has been going on and off having fires, and that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Chairman Yaksko yesterday reported to Congress had no more water and was giving off very high radiation levels. I've seen in the news reports that France and England are calling for their citizens to leave. Their citizens, yeah, to leave Japan. So the fuel pool at Unit 4 is very troubled and has enormous, very much
and a meltdown
potential
there.
For damage there. Yes, and then you ask if I know if the pressure vessels have been breached. The pressure vessels themselves, which are the metal that holds the core, I don't know. I have not seen reports that those have actually been breached. But what we do know is that the tops of these, as the fuel melts, the radioactivity can be getting out into the air and into the environment, and the levels reportedly are varying higher and lower and higher, and all unessential workers have been removed from the site. At one point they were down to 50 or 60 workers, and even those had to be taken away and and shielded for a while. They'd been receiving what looks like lifetime doses. And so the monitoring and reporting is really not adequate. Mm-hmm. We don't know still how much radioactivity was released at Three Mile Island. We don't know how much for sure. I mean, we can calculate how much was probably released from Chernobyl and from Three Mile Island. And in these situations, we're talking about four reactors, potentially six reactors, and 6-7 irradiated fuel pools just at that one unit, that one complex that we're talking about. And there are more reactors not too far up the coast. So one reactor at Three Mile Island with a partial melt, which was, people are still suffering health effects from that, and the kinds of cover-ups, you may want to do some show on the cover-ups of the health effects at Three Mile Island. And at Chernobyl, people are clearly suffering the health effects from that, and the estimates range from the industry saying just in the tens of people dying to John Goffman in the hundreds of thousands dying. So from cancer in the long run. Now, for Seabrook, there's a CRAC 2 report, Consequences of Reactor Accident Report, that was released in 1982. It was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in Sandia. They studied the meltdown risks at U.S. nuclear power plants. And Seabrook was at that time projected to, if there was a meltdown and a release, that the peak early fatalities were estimated would be 700, the peak early injuries would be 2,700, and the peak cancer deaths 6,000, with an estimated cost of $163 billion that was based on the 1982 population and dollars.
Wow.
For Pilgrim, which is down by Boston,
yes,
3,000 peak early fatalities, 30,000 peak early injuries, and 23,000 peak cancer deaths, with a cost in 1982 dollars of $81.8 billion. And for Vermont Yankee, just doing the ones around your listenership,
yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
The peak early fatalities were projected at 7,000, the peak early injuries at 3,000, and the peak cancer deaths at 17,000, with the property damage in billions, $68.8 billion. So that was the
1982.
About 30 years ago. So right. I'm sure the populations have increased.
Tremendously.
The
yes,
cost.
They have.
So, and I want to make sure people understand that Vermont Yankee and Pilgrim are the same design.
That was my next question. How different or similar are U.S. plants to Fukushima?
We have 23 reactors in the United States that are the same. They are the General Electric Mark I reactors, 3 in Alabama, 2 in North Carolina, 1 in Nebraska, 4 in Illinois. Vermont has that one, Vermont Yankee. New York has 2, not too far from you, up in Oswego, New York, Fitzpatrick and 9 Mile 1. Massachusetts has the one at Pilgrim. Minnesota has one. New Jersey has 2. And Pennsylvania has 2. And back in 1971, there was a, it was in the Atomic Energy Commission, predates the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. On our website at www.nirs.org, www.nirs.org, mm-hmm. we've got these actual memos posted. And they're memos that show the, from within the Atomic Energy Commission, listing the concerns and problems with the design of the Mark I boiling water reactors.
My.
This is before we had these 23 reactors licensed. Memos from the from Stephen Hanauer, who worked at the Atomic Energy Commission, pointing out the problems, why the reactors should not be licensed. And I want to read the response from the higher-up official, safety official, Joseph Hendry at NRC. With regard to Steve's memo, Steve's idea to ban pressure suppression containment schemes, that's what I described earlier with the not actually having a thick containment dome, but actually having a system that's supposed to convert the steam into liquid and reduce the pressure. That's mm-hmm. their idea of pressure suppression containment, is an attractive one in some ways. However, the acceptance of pressure suppression containment concepts by all elements in the nuclear field, including regulatory, is firmly embedded in conventional wisdom. Reversal of this hallowed policy, reversal of this hallowed policy, particularly at this time, could well be the end of nuclear power. It would throw into question the continued operation of licensed plants, would make unlicensable the GE and Westinghouse ice condenser plants now under review, and would generally create more turmoil than I can stand thinking about. September 25th, 1972, top safety official at the Atomic Energy Commission, Joseph Hendry, dismissing the concerns that were raised by Stephen Hanauer that actually have been seen now 40 years later here in Japan and potentially at 23 sites in the United States.
Well, one final question before we switch off to the second half. Japan is at the apex of three tectonic plates. It's earthquake central, and you know why they would build nuclear plants there is just beyond me. But what about these places? We're not on earthquake faults, although Seabrook is actually on an earthquake fault. Does that mean worst case seismic scenarios, they should be pretty safe? That it's different enough. Your response?
Well, the reactors, the most sturdy earthquake resistant reactors are designed for a 7, an earthquake on the Richter scale of 7, and they weren't expecting something higher in Japan. There's something interesting I want to point out. My coworker made this realization, is that when these reactors were being designed and licensed in the early 70s, the theory of plate tectonics was not even, it was just in its infancy.
Oh, no.
So we didn't know that there were plate tectonics and about these, the ring of fire and these ridges of, movement under the earth.
Wow.
It was not even known at the time that these reactors were being designed and sited and approved. Seabrook's newer, yes. Seabrook does have the heavier protection containment dome, but Three Mile Island had the thickest, most protective containment dome, and radiation got out in that partial meltdown. And so I do not believe that we should be consoled. And there was deliberate venting outside of the reactors to reduce pressure in Japan.
That.
And so, and this has happened with the kind of reactor at Seabrook has its own issues. Steam generator tubes can rupture. There have been numerous of these generic safety issues happening around the country with radioactive steam from the core being directly vented, either deliberately or accidentally, out into the environment. And it's a direct pathway. There are problems that can happen there. And the point, I guess, would be that you can't predict everything. They weren't able to predict an earthquake and a tsunami and a loss of power and all of that at once. And that's what happened. And we always see that underestimating risks is how the industry operates.
And they lie, too. It is a fact that they do lie, and we'll talk about that on the second hour.
Yeah, I hope that your next guest will talk about the $650 million that the industry has spent on lobbying from 1999 to 2008, and then in the first three quarters of 2009, $84 million just to lobby Congress, and that there was a report yesterday that the Nuclear Energy Institute top lobbyist visited more than 100 different offices on Capitol Hill to reassure them about nuclear power. And that is something that I did. I myself am here in D.C. I went to Congress to the hearings on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Department of Energy budget yesterday just to see what things look like. There's a completely different world there. We're hearing about devastation. We're looking at these pictures of people being evacuated, being measured for radioactivity. And on Capitol Hill, in the Congress, we're still seeing our elected officials touting nuclear power and nuclear energy, wanting to give the $36 billion that the Obama administration is wanting to give of our tax dollars to the nuclear industry and loan guarantees. This is all, it's just happening.
It's crazy.
Complete denial of what's going on. And it's incumbent upon listeners, people who do care, to make sure that your elected officials and this administration are bombarded with opposition to using our taxpayer money for new nuclear in this country. We need to stop the license extensions on Pilgrim and all the other license extensions that are being proposed in this country. And we need to have immediate real-time monitoring to protect ourselves from the plumes as they come, at least notify ourselves of the plumes that are inevitably going to be coming across from Japan around the world.
Yes.
The whole background, our food chains are going to be affected by this, no matter what kind of denials we're going to hear from the nuclear industry about supposedly safe levels, which in fact do not exist.
Right. Well, Diane Darrigo, NIRS.org is a place to go.
That's
for
right.
More information. NIRS.org. Thank you so much, and let's hope that more like this doesn't happen here. But people have to get on it and not just let the experts decide. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, and we will be back, and hopefully it can't happen here.
It can't happen here. It can't happen here. I'm telling you, my dear, that it can happen here. Because I've been checking it out, baby. I checked it out a couple of times. And I'm telling you, it can't happen here. Oh, darling, it's important that you believe me, bop, 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 that it can't happen here. Who could imagine that they would freak out somewhere in Kansas? Kansas, could imagine that they would freak out in Minnesota.
Frank and the boys fooling around. Who could imagine? Can't happen here. Well, let's hope. Well, more than just hope, let's do something to make sure it can't happen here. Bert Cohen here. This is the Bert Cohen Show. And we're talking about nukes. We're talking about Fukushima. We're talking about how much power the nuclear industry still has in these United States. And Barack Obama, he was telling the truth when he campaigned. He said he was for nuclear power. And as our previous guest was saying, when you get to Washington right now, there's still... We need more nukes. We need more nukes. And with us on the line is Justin Elliott, columnist for Salon.com. Thanks for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show today, Justin.
Glad to be here.
And I hear that in the past few years, we're going to talk about the spin by the nuclear industry. They are big. They are powerful. There's a tremendous amount of money involved. They have spent over $168 million just lobbying Congress just recently, and they're still at it. And the reason, obviously, is they've had a bit of a public relations problem since 1979, Three Mile Island. What have been the nuclear industry's successful arguments in turning around public opinion? Basically, what did they learn from Three Mile Island? Safety or spin?
Right. Well, you're right to say that Three Mile Island was really devastating for them. It's actually still true that in the past 30 years, there has not been a new nuclear power plant built in this country since that happened. So it was certainly, I mean, and that wasn't the only factor. There are other factors, too. I mean, the other backdrop for all of this is, this is an industry that requires federal subsidies to exist. I mean, it's so expensive to build one of these power plants that they need multi-billion-dollar federal loan guarantees in order to even build a new power plant. So that's really sort of the key necessity to keep in mind. But over the past, I'd say, 5 or 10 years, the message that they've been sending is that nuclear power is safe and clean. And the clean part of that specifically relates to the fact that nuclear power does not release carbon emissions that, of course, cause climate change, which is in the past decade obviously been a much bigger issue than it was, say, in the 80s and 90s. And the safe part of that is sort of the response to Three Mile Island that, you know, the technology is better now, there's excellent regulation, and this is I'm giving you their message.
Oh, sure.
Here.
Yes.
So basically, that has been, I mean, it's really just been those two themes coming from the industry for many years.
And it really actually, in the production of the nuclear fuel, the uranium, there is a fair amount of carbon that is emitted. And so they learn from Three Mile Island to deal with these public relations issues. What was their fear? What was the problem as they saw it from Three Mile Island, and how have they been operating since then? Is it that there was a public perception problem that the things weren't safe? Is that what it was? Or what did it have to do with expense?
Well, I think it was actually a combination of issues, and those were two of the big ones. I mean, you always have had and still do have the issue of what to do with the spent nuclear fuel. You know, there's been an effort for a long time in order to get a storage facility built in Yucca Mountain,
right,
in Nevada, but that's never happened because there's been, you know, people in Nevada, including some powerful people like Harry Reid, the majority leader, the majority leader of the Senate, obviously strongly opposed that. You have the what to do with the fuel issue. You have the money issue, which is essentially that the industry needs to get, as I said, multi-billion-dollar federal loan guarantees in order to build any new plants, just because it's so expensive. And then you have the issue of safety. And as you say, after Three Mile Island, a lot of the assumptions about whether nuclear was safe or whether you could trust the industry or even the federal regulators who are supposed to be keeping track of all this became a problem. And so the industry has been mounting public relations campaigns essentially ever since then in order to fix these problems. So I'll give you an example. About 6 or 7 years ago, the trade group of the industry, which is called the Nuclear Energy Institute, created a new campaign that was called, or still exists, it's called the Clean and Safe Energy Coalition. And that's really the entire message is right in the name, Clean and Safe Energy. And they got some pretty big names to chair this initiative. It's co-chaired by Christine Todd Whitman, who was the former EPA administrator during the Bush administration, and also Patrick Moore, who was actually one of the founders of Greenpeace, who later turned into a big booster for nuclear power. So these two have been going around for years, writing op-eds, giving speeches, everything that one does in a public relations campaign, sort of hammering away on the themes that nuclear is safe and it's clean. So that's a taste, at least, of what they're doing. And, of course, all of this costs a lot of money. They poured millions of dollars into it.
We are talking with Salon.com columnist Justin Elliott about the spin doctors in the nuclear industry. So Christine Todd Whitman, she was a former EPA administrator. Is she really out front? Is she one of the faces of pro-nuclear, you know, like all smiles and good for the neighborhood?
Certainly, certainly. She's been out there a lot. I actually tried to look into how much she's paid to be the co-chair of this Clean and Safe Energy Coalition, and that information seems to be private, but you can assume that she's paid pretty handsomely. She's certainly been out there. You know, for example, last year after the BP oil spill, you know, the nuclear industry, of course, saw this as an opportunity because it was this obviously epic disaster involving oil. And Christine Todd Whitman wrote some op-eds at the time. I quote one of them in a piece I wrote for Salon.com, in which she used the word safety 5 times in one paragraph. So the messaging, it's not subtle, but as I said, I mean, the fact that this emphasis has been on safety for so many years is precisely why what's happening in Japan right now is so damaging, so devastating to the message of the industry, because all of the assumptions about backup safety systems seem to be called into question here. I mean, a term that the PR people for the industry will throw around a lot is redundancies. And, you know, what that refers to is having many layers of backup safety systems and cooling systems. Now, of course, in Japan, we've seen that those, even though they had several layers of backup systems, they basically all have failed for one reason or another. There was a fairly devastating article in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago that was asking the question of whether the entire premise that there can be enough redundancies in a nuclear power plant to protect it in all circumstances. So, yeah, so this is definitely a crisis for the industry.
I'll bet it is. Well, have you seen any signs of what their spin is going to be? Somehow I can't imagine them saying, oh, sorry, we were wrong. Redundancy is not enough. All kinds of things can still go wrong. I guess we're wrong. Well, sorry about that. Nuclear power is bad. Somehow I don't think they're going to do that. What's their reaction been so far?
You're right. Your guess is right on. Well, on Sunday, when this was still, what was happening in Japan is still in pretty early stages, I interviewed a spokesman for the industry trade group, which, as I mentioned before, is called the Nuclear Energy Institute, based down in Washington. They do a lot of lobbying on Capitol Hill and also public relations work. And I interviewed one of their main spokesmen in order to get a sense of what they're saying. And part of the message that I got, and this was strikingly bold, is that according to this spokesman for the industry, Americans should be, quote, reassured, and he used the word reassured, by what's happening in Japan, because even though there have been problems there, that means that American nuclear operators will learn from those problems, and that therefore this should be reassuring. So that was, I thought, a pretty bold line. A few days later, another advocate for the industry told the Associated Press that if ultimately the radiation is contained in Japan at the stricken power plant there, that this may end up being actually a success story for the industry. And again, that's a quote. He used the term success story. Now, I think that's a pipe dream. Oh. I think there's absolutely no way this is going to be seen as a success story, but you got to give them points for boldness, at least.
That's true. You got to give them points for boldness. We are talking with columnist Justin Elliott, writes for Salon.com. Safe, you know, it's interesting. It was the concept of double speak, and was about the future, 1984. That you know, whatever you say is a total lie. And if they say safety, 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 kind of you get the realization, hey, maybe there's a problem with safety. I think it's interesting that the owner of the nearby Seabrook station, called Next Era Florida Power and Light, they went bankrupt a few years ago, and they found somebody willing to buy the darn thing. They called Seabrook Station, quote, a safe, reliable, and low-cost producer of electricity. Next Era Florida Power and Light says, quote, in fact, our designs and ongoing maintenance programs are specifically based on a number of factors, including the likely worst-case seismic scenario for the location of the plant. Now, it is on a fault line. How well do you think that'll work?
Well, I mean, I think over.
I mean, it sounds like
the description you just gave of safe, reliable, and low cost. I think the only one of those three that's true is the reliable part. I mean, it's certainly once you have one of these plants,
right.
You do get a reliable source of energy, but. As we've seen last week, it's the safety part's questionable, and the low cost part is actually absurd.
No, it's absurd.
Nuclear is extremely expensive, and I think even the industry will admit that. They acknowledge that, as I said, they essentially need large federal subsidies in order to operate. So I think on the California issue, I think there's going to be a lot of reporting on that in the next few weeks. I saw a story today on Huffington Post doing a close look at one of the nuclear power plants that's near a fault line in California, and there are real questions about whether there's been emergency planning for those plants with respect to a large earthquake, and if there has been planning, whether it goes up to, say, a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, which is what happened in Japan. And of course, one of the problems with the plant in Japan is that there are contingency scenarios. I believe only went up to a 7.0.
Right.
And so obviously that's not, I mean, obviously you saw a 9.0, so they were not prepared. So I think, and you've actually already seen a couple people in Congress, including Ed Markey of Massachusetts,
right,
who's been a big critic of the industry, saying that we need to take a close look immediately at plants in this country that are on or near fault lines to see if they're safe in case of earthquake.
Well, your understanding of the power of the nuclear industry in Congress, where they spent a great deal of money, and as Bob Dylan once said, money doesn't talk, it swears, and they have a tremendous amount of power in Washington. Ed Markey has been there for a long time, always casting doubts on the nuclear industry. What do you think will happen now? Will the power of money, the nuclear industry, they'll still have it to throw around? I would think that the credibility of the nuclear industry is taking a significant hit. I would like to think people are getting that. Could the Markey thing be, could things have changed so much that maybe the Markey initiative to slow down on this stuff, will it have legs? I heard from our previous guest that in Washington, they're still pushing for another $36 billion in subsidies to the nuclear industry. What do you predict will happen in Congress now? Will they listen to the people or the nuclear industry?
Well, I think it's a little bit too early to say. I mean, you've seen a couple things already. One thing that I think was a very big deal was that the White House Press Secretary, Jay Carney, came out a few days ago and said that President Obama still supports nuclear power. He still thinks that it should be part of the mix or something like that.
Right.
So I think that was a huge boost for the industry. As you mentioned in the introduction, Barack Obama has been a longtime supporter of the industry. He campaigned on it. He was a supporter when he was a politician on the state level in Illinois, when he was a senator. So he is clearly the most powerful and most important supporter of nuclear power in the country. You also have a fair amount of support on the Republican side. Now, I think there's a good chance that that what Ed Markey is talking about in terms of doing a look at safety in our power plants, that something will happen on that front, at the very least hearings about it. Now, as for whether this is going to be a death knell for the industry in this country going forward, I think it's too early to say. I mean, I think in part it depends on what happens in Japan. You know, it's still sort of a fast-moving situation. Things seem to be getting worse from what I've read.
Right.
But, you know, if they're able to stop any more radiation releases, I think that'll help the industry's position. If this turns out to be an absolute catastrophe, I think the industry in this country is going to have a real problem. So I think the thing to do in the next couple of weeks is to watch very closely what the administration is saying, what various members of Congress are saying. So far, they've been, I think you could generally characterize it as cautiously supportive.
Cautiously supportive, yeah. Now, I wonder, I think you bring up an interesting point. If, and let us hope, that they are able to get Fukushima under control and that they are able to, you know, control any horrible, disastrous meltdown and there's not too much radiation, I would think then they, the nuclear industry, the spin machine, could say, look, here is this unbelievable, not predictable accident, earthquake, tsunami, everything that went wrong could go wrong, and yet it still survived okay. Now, I wonder, that I would think would be certainly a gift to the nuclear industry. That could say that, you know, that the worse than the worst case scenario happened, and look, we still survived. Who, do you know who is the, is there one particular PR firm that handles the nuclear boys?
Well, the argument that you just outlined there, I think you're exactly right. If that does happen, if they get it under control in Japan, even though there clearly has already been some radiation released, I don't think we really know for sure how much or how many workers right. or even people in the broader population have gotten exposed. But they will definitely make that argument. There's no question in my mind. They're actually already making that argument. As I mentioned before, there was somebody told the Associated Press who works in the industry that if that happens, then this is a major, quote, success story.
Right.
So definitely look out for that. In terms of the PR firm that works for them,
right.
it's actually this trade group, the Nuclear Energy Institute, which, as I said, is based in Washington, and they have a budget of about $40 or $50 million a year. And basically, it's a membership organization. Many large industries have this in Washington. So they have about 300 or 400 members, and that includes all of the major corporations in the United States that own or operate nuclear power plants. Interestingly, this Washington-based Nuclear Energy Institute also represents firms in other countries, including Japan, including TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, which is the company, of course, that owns the plant that is in crisis right now. So they have a large in-house public relations apparatus these people talk to reporters, they do briefings, as well as a large lobbying operation. And this is, you know, this is a lucrative business. These people, the president of the Nuclear Energy Institute was paid $1.5 million in 2010. So this is this is a big business. It's a serious operation.
So Dave, I'm sure, said that, well, actually, they must have a website. I think that might be fun for listeners to check it out and see what they can see. Do you know what the website is of the Nuclear Information or Nuclear Energy Institute?
Yep, it's the acronym NEI.org.
NEI.org.
Yeah.
Well,
and they have and they certainly have a response up. They're updating with information. They have various Twitter accounts. It's a very professional website. And also, I've written several articles that people can get. If you just search my name, Justin Elliott, Salon.com, I've been pretty closely tracking the messages coming out of the Nuclear Energy Institute for the past week.
So you're not on the payroll of the Nuclear Energy Institute?
No, not that I... Sadly, I'd be making a lot more money if I were.
Yeah, well, you know, I remember many years ago, the Seabrook people, the proponents were saying, if we didn't build a nuclear plant here at Seabrook, we would, I'm not making this up, we'd be taking cold showers and have to eat raw, uncooked food. I'm not kidding. They actually said that stuff. And I couldn't make it up. And now I would think, you know, for years they've been saying, well, if we don't have nuclear power, the one big solution, all these other guys, yeah, wind, solar, it's, you know, it's sort of flaky. It's kind of out there stuff. And it seems to me they've been successful at that. Nuclear is big. Nuclear does produce a heck of a lot of electricity. It does. You know, about 20% of America's power has come from nuclear power. And, you know, they've just dismissed the little guys. I would think that this might be an opportunity for the sustainable energy to perhaps invest some dollars. And, well, certainly on TV lately, the natural gas industry has cranked up their public relations budget. That's for sure. So it could
be. Actually, yeah, I mean, there's actually an interesting dynamic going on in the last year or two, which is natural gas prices have gone way down, partly because there's a lot more exploration and drilling for natural gas happening in the United States and a lot of these shale projects that you may have heard of.
Yes.
And as a result of that, nuclear has actually been looking less attractive from a purely economic standpoint, and they've been losing some support in the federal government because it costs so much money to get a nuclear power plant on the line when natural gas, at least in the short term, is so cheap. Nuclear starts looking a lot less palatable.
Well, as we said earlier, nuclear power is basically, at its essence, an insane way to boil water. Justin Elliott, thank you so much for being with us and shedding some light on that. And we'll keep track of it again if you want to track the nuclear industry, NEI.org. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show, Justin.
Thank you.
All right. And let's hope for the best here. And this is Adrian Belew here singing an appropriate song, Burned by the Fire We Made.
And when man gained dominion over land and the ocean, he began to harm the planet with his asphalt and his toxins, and to lay the forest bare, and to poison even the air, and he killed every beast and taught the seas how to bleed. Burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make. What a shame. Then the winds gave in, and the rain in no season, and the sun came to beat on a land of sand and diseases. And when God looked down on the earth and saw it was broken, then the tears of God fell down through a hole in the ozone. Burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make. What a shame.